a t-shirt and jeans, mac and cheese. Some things in life are an obvious match, like RIAs and Schwab Advisor Services, the number one choice for independent advisors. The difference is so obvious, it's Schwabvious. Learn why at schwabvious.com.
Let's talk. Talk.
John Brown. To say that I have been looking forward to speaking to our next guest about our next subject. Last night I was somewhat like about like an 8-year-old on too many after 8 mints on the night before Christmas, because you know me, listeners, and you know that I am that worst creature in the world, an armchair historian who can bore you rigid with facts about the Second World War, mechanized infantry, etc., etc. And then I get to speak to Saul David, who has written a book called Tunisgrad, which will turn the way that you think the one of the most important campaigns that's been overlooked in the Second World War on its head. Delighted to say that I am joined by, and I'm trying not to sort of become too much of a groupie, but it's Saul David. Saul, good morning to you, sir.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, I'm just, you know, I mean, I've been listening to podcasts about this book, and it is obviously your enthusiasm and passion for this particular theatre of operation, which has been massively overlooked, just signs through, and I cannot wait to get my hands on the book.
Yeah, well, I'm delighted to hear that. It's obviously having the effect I intended it to. I mean, it is amazing, really, when you think about it, that historians have concentrated on two major turning points in the Second World War. That's Stalingrad in the on the Eastern Front and Guadalcanal in the Pacific. And they missed this other one that took place almost at exactly the same time, involved the first time the Western Allies, that's the Americans and the British, had fought together in a single campaign, but one that had enormously far-reaching consequences and yet somehow has slipped off the radar.
Because if you think about it, people mainly think, if you say Second World War to most people, they'll have a timeline that goes Dunkirk, Battle of Britain, D-Day landings, fall of Berlin, maybe Stalingrad, if, you know, whatever. And this is a world war, and so there's so many stories. And also, we have to look at the Mediterranean in an entirely different light, because people think soft underbelly of Europe. So what does it really, it doesn't really matter what happens in Africa. They may have seen, you know, the Indiana Jones movies for the Africa Corps, and everybody will know Rommel. But this actually shows how vitally important the Mediterranean is, and the effect that it has on training, the preparation. It's the first time the Americans come into the war, and the cast of characters, Ike, Bradley, Monty, Rommel, you can't get better than that.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, what's so fascinating about the Americans is that when they came into the war in the end of 41, now admittedly, they didn't want to come into the war at that stage. They were forced in by Japan's sneak attack at Pearl Harbor. They'd already agreed on a policy with the British, which was known as Germany First. It was the strategy to defeat Germany and then we'll turn on Japan. So they knew what they wanted to do. They didn't know how they were going to do it. Now, the Americans' instinct was to go for the throat. We'll get our troops into Northwest Europe via the UK. So we're going to build up a lot of troops in the UK. Then we'll invade Northwest Europe. Then we'll cross France and get into Germany and it'll be job done. But of course, it was going to be much more complicated than that, not least because in 1942, they didn't have enough troops in the UK. So they're casting around for what to do next. And their chiefs of staff, their senior military advisors to Roosevelt, the president, were very much of, let's do that. Let's get into Northwest Europe. And Churchill and his chiefs of staff, of course, who knew the difficulty of doing that, said, no, listen, there's other ways we can really harm the German war effort. And one of those ways is by invading North Africa. Why? Because it's going to give you control over the shipping routes of the Mediterranean. You also mentioned open up the south of the Mediterranean to attack, which, of course, is exactly what happens in 1943 and 1944. It's also going to be a chance to draw in a lot of Axis forces to North Africa. Again, exactly what happened, and degrade those forces, and in particular Air Force. I mean, it's amazing how much of the Axis, particularly German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, is knocked out in North Africa. So there were huge benefits for the Western Allies, if only they can persuade the Americans. And luckily, Roosevelt, a former assistant secretary to the Navy in the United States administration, well before he became president, understood sea power. He didn't want to lose vast numbers of soldiers in a premature attack on fortress Europe. He was very much taken with Churchill's idea, the so-called peripheral strategy. You contain Germany by blockade, bombing, small raids, and an attack on North Africa until it's sufficiently weakened by its efforts in Russia for a knockout blow on the continent. So it's all about timing in the end. And the timing was not right in 42 to go into Northwest Europe. That would have been a disaster, but it was right to go into North Africa for all the reasons I've just mentioned. And the training and the ability to fight together with the Americans for the first time on a battleground that's not going to be quite as all or nothing as it would have been in Northwest Europe.
And of course, to thank for all this, we've got Mussolini, who wants to build a second Roman Empire. He's used chemical weapons and bombing in Abyssinia. He's in Tunisia, he's in Tripoli, etc. It's all part. So, Mussolini has got his white horse ready to ride triumphantly into the victory, right? And people go, okay, it's a strip of desert, but it's not, because two words, not one, two words, Suez Canal.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Mussolini's strategy, as you say, a new Roman Empire. He already possessed Libya, or at least Italy had done since 1912. He, of course, had launched an incursion into Abyssinia, very unpopular, castigated by the League of Nations. But the League of Nations was about as toothless as the United Nations is now. So that didn't make any difference. And he wanted to join up those two colonies for Italy, and he was going to do it by taking Egypt, which wasn't a British colony, but it was a former British mandate that was still garrisoned by British and Commonwealth troops. But as you say, the Suez Canal is absolutely crucial to the story of the Second World War. It is a line of communication from the rest of the British Empire back into Europe. It also would allow the British to effectively control the oil fields of the Middle East. And if you control them, it means the Axis don't. I mean, we know, don't we, that the Stalingrad campaign was predicated on Germany getting its hands on the oil fields of the Caucasus. Yep. Well, Rommel, of course, who sent to North Africa to bail out the Italians after their initial campaign in 1940 goes horribly wrong, absolutely understands the benefit of not only getting to the Suez Canal, but also possibly another land attack, a southern pincer attack on the oil fields of the Caucasus, as well as controlling the oil fields in the Middle East. So it's a real lost opportunity for Germany, because what's interesting about the story in Tunisgrad, which really starts with Operation Torch, that's the American-British landings in French North Africa, is that at that point, Hitler absolutely understands the importance of North Africa. But if he understood it then, why didn't he see the strategic possibilities earlier and put more troops, men and material in? He's going to now, he doubles down, but in a sense, war is all about timing, as in everything in life is about timing. It was too late by that point. Yes, it's going to be a long, tough, hard-fought campaign, which actually goes both ways. I mean, people effectively think of the North African campaign over when Monty wins the Battle of El Alamein, but not true at all. This fighting in Tunisia is really, ding-dong battle that goes on for 6 months. But the consequences at the end of that is that the Axis are entirely removed from North Africa. They no longer have any real sway over the shipping lanes in the Mediterranean. And this is a crucial turning point, as I said when we first started this discussion, that's never really been recognized up to now. And the only reason I can think of for that is one that American historians are still slightly sore that we encouraged their chiefs of staff, or at least forced their chiefs of staff via Roosevelt, to take this relatively unpopular action. They didn't want to do it. It was just going to draw them into more shenanigans in the Mediterranean. They're thinking this is just about the defense of British Empire, but it wasn't. It was that as well, but it was genuinely an understanding among the British that this is the best way we can hurt Germany at this stage of the war.
And of course, the Italians fight relatively well. There's always this great thing about Italian tanks having 16 reverse gears and one forward. And that's a great disservice because, at the beginning of the campaign, they are doing well. And the other thing, of course, is because if you say North Africa, Africa Corps, etc., as it then becomes, people will think, British troops in shorts, mainly British, mainly sort of white people, and I'm not going to get all diverse on you, but again, Suez is really important for getting troops in from the empire, which are going to call, which are going to become very, very important indeed. There are larger numbers of Indian forces in it. There are large numbers of New Zealand, South Africans. South Africans actually have got the garrison at Tobruk, of course, which is perhaps, and it's, you know, 30,000 people going in the bag because, and just after the fall of Singapore, and Churchill is not happy about that, is he, Saul?
No, I mean, this is, in many ways, this is the low point of the North African campaign. The loss of Tobruk to Rommel in the summer of 1942, which, by the way, was the moment at which they were making the final decision on whether to go into French North Africa or not. So it was really bad news for Churchill. He gets the news when he's in Washington, D.C., trying to convince Roosevelt that his idea of going into French North Africa is the correct one, as opposed to invading France prematurely. And he gets this news from Tobruk that they've lost this absolutely vital port in what had been Italian Libya, and this now opens up the route for Rommel to get into Egypt and possibly take the Suez Canal. So it's a real dark moment. He says in his memoirs, you know, defeat is one thing, disgrace is another. The loss of all those troops, you know, the second worst defeat of British arms or British and Commonwealth arms in the Second World War, as you mentioned. I mean, the worst was Singapore, which had happened a few months earlier. But it's a real shock to the system. But it is interesting that that is the high point of the Axis advance or the Axis campaign in North Africa. And although they do get into Egypt, they're stopped at the first battle of El Alamein. And of course, ultimately, they're going to lose the second one. And it's backwards all the way back to Tunisia thereafter. So it is an important moment. And it does show you that even by the summer of 1942, there was still a real risk that Egypt was going to fall. Fortunately, we had some very good people out there. We put some good people in place. That's Montgomery and Alexander, his superior. And they steadied the ship. And with the assistance of American tanks and an increasing number of troops being sent to Egypt, they gradually turned the tables on Rommel. And he is forced all the way back to Tunisia. And people often forget this final stage of the campaign, all the fighting in Tunisia. Rommel with his army and then another Axis commander, von Arnim, another German commander, with his Panzer army. So there are an awful lot of troops in Tunisia by the early point port, by the early part of 1943.
But the thing is, again, Hitler's on a train, isn't he? He's on his train. Is he going to werewolf? Because he loves his eagle's nest, his wolf's lair. He's got what, I don't know, werewolf town or something in Ukraine. And he's on a tour of his trains with, and he's got his staff with him, his fanboys. He's Nazi fanboys, and he gets the news that the Americans have landed in Casablanca. And actually, they're not only just Americans, they're also British troops in American kits, so because they don't want to upset the French. And that's, the French is, you've got French fighting French at some point, because you've got Vichy and Nazi-controlled France. So Hitler sort of basically goes, right, in which case, and flings the cream, you could argue, some of the best troops the German army have at North Africa. And we're talking Fallschirmjäger, we're talking Tiger tanks. The damage that this does to the Luftwaffe and how that will have a knock-on effect on air superiority when it comes to Eastern Front, was it 500 flights to planes they have against the half billion Russians? And also that whole air superiority over Nazi. So without this campaign, without Torch, you've got no air superiority, which means you've got no overlord. Game over.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, one thing leads to another, as it tends to do in war. I mean, people often forget this really important point about the fighters or air power more generally. I mean, for some reason, there's still this absolute conviction. And by the way, there's a knock on into the current Ukraine war at the moment that numbers will always win wars. It's complete fallacy. What wins wars are economic power. And one of the ways you leverage economic power is you squeeze your opponent's ability to, you know, produce the vital things it needs for war. So you can see the Ukrainians currently are trying to degrade the Russian ability to produce oil, therefore sell oil, therefore make arms. I mean, it makes complete sense. It's economic war warfare that has a real effect on your opponent's ability to fight. And exactly the same thing was being done by the British and the Americans in the Second World War. You don't need to fight with vast numbers of troops on the ground to win a war. You need to degrade the enemy's ability to do that. So you knock out all its fighters by sending in huge numbers of bombers, huge fleets of bombers to not only destroy the ability to make new fighters, but also to degrade the fighters, that is to knock them out in combat over Germany. And what's fascinating about 1944, which is obviously a knock-on effect of Tuna's grab, but also the strategic bombing campaign, is that the vast majority of German air power is now in the Reich. It's not in Normandy and it's not on the Eastern Front. So both of those places are denuded of the ability to protect their troops on the ground, and air power is absolutely crucial to understanding the success of the Second World War, or who wins the Second World War, because they're defending in Germany and because they've lost so many planes in the Mediterranean. And it's these connections that are often not made by historians who think, well, of course, nine out of every 10 German soldiers were killed on the Eastern Front. So obviously that's where the war was won and lost. But it's a misunderstanding what wins wars. And it's not the death of soldiers on the battlefield. It's the ability of an economy to keep, its government in the fight.
And also, of course, you lose a German air crewman, you lose a German pilot, you've got to train a new one up. And that's okay if you're in the UK, because you can send them to Canada and get trained where it's nice and safe. You can't train a new Luftwaffe guy up while they're being bombed by the 101st coming out of East Norfolk, can you?
No, that's right. I mean, what you see with German air power as the war goes on, and more of its veteran pilots get knocked out. So you may have the same number of planes. You may be able to reproduce planes. Well, they weren't actually. But anyway, let's go with that sort of argument. But you've lost your experienced pilots. They've been killed in North Africa. They've been killed in over Britain during the Battle of Britain. They've been killed during the various campaigns that don't succeed. And although some of their best pilots have enormous numbers of victories on the Eastern Front, where they're up against Russian pilots in much more inferior planes, or at least in the early stage of the war, this all turns completely on its head by the end of the war. And I've just been writing a chapter for a forthcoming book called Twilight of the Gods, which is the battle for Europe 1944 and 1945. And you can see that Operation Bagration, which is the hugely successful operation that the Russians launch against Army Group Center in the summer of 1944, just after D-Day, is such an easy success for the Russians for multiple factors. But one of the biggest ones is that the Germans simply do not have any planes to resist this attack. So whereas before they were in the ascendancy, now they've got one plane for every 10 of the Russians, and the Russians completely sweep them out of the sky. And it's not an image really that we really associate with the Second World War, but that was the reality on the ground as a result of the North African campaign, strategic bombing and various other elements of warfare that had happened up to this point.
Now, can we blow a romantic notion out of the water once and for all? Rommel. Because he is, if you go by James Mason in the films and the whole thing, we see him as quote unquote the good German. Because he is given very little choice. But just give me a little bit of background, because he's not this sort of martyr for the Wehrmacht, is he, Saul?
No, I feel very ambivalent about Rommel, I have to say. I mean, on the one hand, I can admire him as a military commander. He makes his name in the First World War as a company commander, actually, during the Battle of Caporetto, in which he leads a reinforced company, a kind of double company, in this extraordinary attack in which he sees a weakness in the enemy lines and just goes for it. And he very much uses those tactics in the Second World War when he's commanding the 7th Panzer Division, the so-called Ghost Division, during the 1940 campaign. And of course, with the Afrika Korps and then his Panzer Army in North Africa, he's a tremendous risk taker. He's brilliant at sensing the weakness in the enemy line and going for it and exploiting. He very much has been schooled in this whole kind of blitzkrieg. He wasn't an armored expert, interestingly enough. But the ambivalence comes with he's very much a fellow traveler with Hitler. He commanded his escort battalion in the 1930s. By the Polish campaign, he's in charge of Hitler's field headquarters. They have many conversations in which, you know, they're both discussing military tactics and strategy. And he's a great fanboy of Hitler at that time. He never joins the Nazi party, it's true, but he is very much in lockstep with Hitler at this rejuvenation of German arms. And it's only when things begin to go horribly wrong in North Africa, where he's really being starved of supplies, men and material, that he begins to turn against the regime. He only finally turns against it in 1944, when, of course, he's commanding the troops trying to repel D-Day, when he absolutely can see the writing on the wall. Does he know about the actual bomb plot itself? Well, he knows that people are trying to assassinate Hitler. He certainly wasn't part of it, but he was part of this movement within the German armed forces to accept that the war was lost. The Western allies probably needed to be invited into Western Europe so that they could then take on the Russians, because most people, Rommel included, saw the Russians as the real long-term threat to German culture and, you know, the German nationhood. And they wanted the Western allies to be invited in and then take on the... And if all of that sounds a bit fanciful, which it might do, you know, just remember that something pretty similar was happening with the Cold War a few years later. But Rommel was a fellow traveller of Hitler. And if the victories had kept coming, I doubt very much he would have turned against Hitler.
But he does go to see Hitler and say, we've got to get our men out. It's going badly wrong. And Hitler says, you know, the usual Hitlerian thing... Last bullets, every city is a citadel. And if they pulled the guys out, because they, was it 300, well, no, 30, is it 350,000 are captured? It's a huge amount of people going to the bag. And if you think, if they'd been in Italy or a Sicily, if they'd been, you know, with their experience, it could have been a very, I mean, I know you hate to do counterfactual history, Saul, but, it is a blessing that Hubert, you know, Hitler's a dumb cop when it comes to strategy, to tactical, strategic warfare.
Yeah, you stay where you are, no retreat. Actually, that there were moments where he did authorize tactical withdrawals, but generally speaking, at this stage of the war, he was absolutely everyone must stand where they are. Now, the Rommel had blotted his copybook by withdrawing against Hitler's express command at El Alamein to save his Panzer Army, and so already he was not entirely trusted by Hitler in a way he had been earlier on in the war, and when he flew to the Werwolf headquarters. You mentioned the Wolf's Lair and the Eagle's Nest. They all have these rather sort of fanciful names. The Werwolf headquarters in Ukraine, where Hitler was observing the Kharkiv counteroffensive, which was quite successful. He was quite bullish, actually, when Rommel got there. Rommel had just been defeated at Medinin, could see the writing on the wall was in North Africa, and made that request, as you pointed out, you know, let me get the guys back to Italy. We've got some veteran troops there. We've got a lot of supplies. We've got men, materials, tanks, planes. Let me get them all back to Italy, and I will guarantee you I will protect the southern flank of Europe. And honestly, it's not a big leap of faith to believe that he would have done that. He was a hugely capable commander. And this was an army of veteran troops that was basically lost in North Africa, which is one of the reasons why Tunisgrad was such a disaster. And by the way, where does the name Tunisgrad come from? It comes from the Germans themselves, who could see the disaster in North Africa, including the great propaganda chief Goebbels, who actually writes in his diary, this is a disaster to as bad as Stalingrad. And that's why the German people were referring to the defeat in North Africa, rather ironically, I suppose, as Tunisgrad. They understood it for what it was. It was an absolute disaster. Just to give you the specific words that Goebbels uses, when you think that 150,000 of our best young people are still in Tunis, you rapidly get an idea of the catastrophe threatening us there. It'll be on the scale of Stalingrad, and certainly also produce the harshest criticism among the German people. Those 150,000, by the way, were Germans. There were another 100,000 Italians, 250,000 in all. How many people captured at Stalingrad? About 115,000, 115. So it was a much bigger disaster in terms of the men lost at the end. It's true that the Stalingrad campaign, more people have been killed and wounded in the campaign as a whole, of course. But nevertheless, it does give you a little bit of a sense of what people in Germany were thinking about this utter catastrophe in North Africa.
And also, also it brings together. If you look at, is it Longstop, the mountain range? The Longstop, which is on the towards the Battle of Tunis, and it shows the, it looks like nothing, as you famously say, it looks like nothing. I've actually got a book on B Division, which I've been leafing through, and it looks like just a very, because the terrain, it's hilly, it's not desert, it's Tunis. If I was to stand on my desk, A, you get a very good view of my ankles, but B, I can see the Rift, I can see Morocco from here, I can see the Rift Mountains. So it's that stony, you've got to get a mule, and not every mule will go there, you know, if you want it to go. So they're having to lug stuff in, it's raining, it's wet, it'll give them a very good understanding of what Italy's going to be like in a couple, you know, in 6 months' time. But it shows the value of having artillery spotters, and that's combined warfare, you know, Mary Cunningham's been doing the same thing in the other side of the desert with the combined arms there. So the Allies learn some really interesting lessons on how to deal with each other, because the forgotten British commander, whose name I forgot, is it Connolly? Who, he's very sort of, he's only about logistics, and, you know, Patton wants to go up there raring with all pearl-handed revolvers firing. And so there's some real lessons learned, aren't there, Saul?
Yeah, so many lessons. The terrain is uniquely difficult. I mean, I traveled out there during research for the book, and actually it's a wonderful place to visit, Tunisia. If you got too far inland, they begin to suggest those are areas that the Foreign Office will advise you not to go to. But the coastal strip, where most of the fighting took place in the hills inland from the coastal strip, is all completely safe and easy to visit. Very beautiful terrain, but very tough. And you can see that holding these relatively small features, because they're not mountains, they're kind of hills in effect, very easy to do, because to get through those hills, through the passes, you've got complete vantage if you hold the high ground. You can bring down artillery fire and mortar fire, which the Germans are very good at. So defensively, this was great training for them in Italy. At the same time, it was good training for the Western Allies to learn how to understand that hills were vital. I mean, you need to take the high ground. You see that in some of the battles in Tunisia, the naivety of the Western Allies, like Kasserine Pass, for example, where the Germans outflank them by climbing up the high ground and getting around their defensive positions. Well, they get much better at understanding. If you're on the defense, you've got to make sure you're in control of the high ground. You can't just have a small number of troops up there. You've got to have a proper, strong defensive position up there. So they do learn a lot of lessons. These are harsh lessons, tough lessons, and it's why it's such a brutally tough campaign to win. But ultimately, by April and May 1943, which, by the way, the actual denouement was just 2 days away from when Eisenhower 15th, had promised his president, Roosevelt, he absolutely gave the date of the 15th at the Casablanca conference, 15th of May. This was 5 months in the future, and he was out by only 2 days. So it's pretty amazing, actually, how close he got. Final surrender by Italian troops. You mentioned Italian troops before. Actually, they fight very well during the Tunisian campaign. Some of them, they're mountain troops. They've got some very good motorized troops too. And they've got a very good general, a man called Giovanni Messi, who commands the army after Rommel leaves. Rommel comes back, asks Hitler, as we've already gone over, if he can get everyone out. Hitler says no, but won't let Rommel go back to North Africa. It's left to Messe and von Arnim to try and cling on. And they manage that for another couple of months. But Messe is the final, gives the final surrender. And I think that's quite symbolic in a way, given that it was originally an Italian escapade, and it was an Italian commander who finally relinquishes all control of North Africa to the Allies.
And von Stauffenberg is getting out of Africa. His plane, his vehicle gets strafed. He loses, doesn't he? He loses an eye in one of his hands and the three digits on his other ones. And you know, this is, if you've watched the film Valkyrie, that's Tom Cruise. If he could if he could only get his fingers back and move the bomb slightly to the left of the bleeding great oak table, the war could have, you know, Hitler could have been dead in his lair a few months earlier than what came to pass.
Yeah, unintended consequences, it's true, but nevertheless, of huge import. Stauffenberg actually went to North Africa, joined the forces in North Africa, partly because he was already a plotter. He was already very anti-Hitler at that point. He'd been a great supporter of the war, and indeed a number of members of the German armed forces, but he was horrified by the atrocities, particularly against the Jews on the Eastern Front, and he'd turned. So he sent to North Africa fights very well. I mean, he's a brilliant staff officer. He's very badly wounded in this strafing attack. And the consequences are not so much the movement of the briefcase, because he's not in the room when the briefcase is fatally moved into its final position, but it's priming the bomb that's the real problem. He doesn't have enough digits to... It's quite a tricky little business, priming a bomb. I won't go into the details.
So realized that I'm going to crush... I'm having so much fun that I'm going to crush the international news from London in about 2 seconds' time. Saul David, thank you so much for your time today.
Brilliant. Thank you.